Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you, rather than to your brothers, one mountain slope or the shoulder of a mountain, which you can still see today, because it is Shechem, way in the north of Palestine, just beside Sychar, the well where Jesus met the woman of Samaria. And it's a strange business. There's a little Mohammedan mosque thing there. Those who've been in Israel can see it. And that is the tomb of Joseph. And what happened was that Joseph died in Egypt, and his body was mummified after the fashion of the Egyptians. And then when Israel came out of Egypt, must have been a great procession, they carried the mummified body of Joseph with them. Extraordinary. Across the Red Sea and through all the desert wanderings, right up into the Promised Land, right up to that mountain shoulder that Jacob had left to Joseph, his boy. And you can still see the tomb of Joseph there to this very day, just beside the well of Samaria, which is now inside a Greek Orthodox church. What a mess it is, too, with images and golden chains and crucifixes and a very conspicuous collection plate. Moreover, I have given to you, rather than to your brothers, one mountain slope, which I took from the hand of the Amorites, with my sword and with my bow." Now, these blessings are really extended in the next chapter. So if you look through to chapter 49, which is the blessings on all the rest of the boys, you'll see what he says about Joseph in verse 22. More concerned with Joseph here, but still you see the motif of fruitful, because that's the meaning of the word Ephraim. 49 and 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough, a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. That's a reference to the spreading of the tribe of Ephraim, way up north. They were away up in the north, one of the most northerly tribes, and their branches ran over the wall, because in fact they spilled out of the land, really into Gentile country, although that was one of the reasons for their corruption later on, because the Gentile empires came in there. Persia came around that way, and also the Greeks came in with their learning and their civilization and their corrupt religion, pouring in from the north. The Romans came in that way with their false gods, in through the north, through Ephraim. And so he was, in the end, corrupted. But this is a reference to the expansion of the tribe. His branches run over the wall. The archers fiercely attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him sorely. And yet his bow remained unmoved. This is Joseph. His arms were made agile by the hands of the Mighty One of Jacob, by the name of the Shepherd, the Rock of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, by God Almighty who will bless you, with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that couches beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb, plenty of children. The blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of the eternal mountains, the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was separate from his brothers. Then may the Lord add a blessing to his own holy word, to his name be the honor and the praise. Closing chapters of the book of Genesis are very full of interest from a Christian point of view. We are now looking at the sunset of Jacob's life, and already the long shadows of mortal weakness and of sickness and in fact of death, because he's mentioned it, are beginning to steal across the career of this great man. And the really extraordinary, not to say intriguing thing is this, that according to the New Testament, this was Jacob's finest hour. That's not how we normally think of advanced old age nowadays, is it? I'm sure that there is in the heart of most folk a dread of old age, part of it healthy, and part of it very unhealthy indeed. We speak about the burden of the years, don't we? And we dread becoming an inconvenience and a nuisance to people. We dread becoming unwanted and unloved and uncared for. And I don't suppose there's anyone here who relishes the idea of becoming decrepit. But according to the New Testament, Jacob's old age was his finest hour. There is, in fact, a promise in the Psalms which says that the saints of God shall be fruitful in their old age and full of sap. In a way in which they were not fruitful in their youth. And Jacob is a splendid fulfillment of just what it means to be fruitful in your old age. Because when he was an old man, ready to die, and when his breath was about to go out of his body, and when he had scarcely enough strength to sit up on the bed and do anything, 2 whole chapters are devoted to the blessing of his sons. And according to Hebrews 11, the roster of the saints and the things they did by faith, that was the thing of most significance that Jacob did in his lifetime. By faith Jacob blessed the sons of Joseph. Do you know that great verse in Hebrews? By faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed the sons of Joseph as he leaned upon his staff. And one of the old commentators used to say that there are 4 parts in the recipe for a fruitful old age. And you find these 4 jewels in the aged Jacob's character. Well, the first 3 are really the trilogy of Christian graces: faith, hope, and love. Now, faith, you see, is something that looks upwards. Because living faith claims the promises of God and lays hold upon the promises of God, not only in old age, but the promises that he has given for old age. You know, there are some beautiful promises for old people, not given to young people at all. Promises for young people too. Promises for the oldies. You oldies, I'm on your side tonight. Here's a word of comfort for the oldies. Faith is something that looks upwards and claims the promises of God and lays hold on the things that God has promised. Have you ever done that in your life? Come to grips with something that God has sworn to do, and you hold on to it, and you hold on to God through it, and you challenge God to keep his word and keep his promise. Have you ever done that? A living faith looks upwards. As well as that, he had a living hope. Now you see, hope looks forwards. Because Jacob, knowing he was dying, he wanted to see the life of God in his family. He wanted his children to grow up in the fear and the love and the faith of the God who had kept him, the God of my fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the angel who redeemed me from all evil he speaks about. Now, Christian hope is like that. It goes forward to the next generation and the generation after that. Faith looks up. Hope looks forward. And that's why two whole chapters are spent in him blessing his sons, because they were his posterity. They were his future. And he wanted the blessing to be channeled through his children. Do you claim that for your children? It's not just enough to send them to Sunday school or Bible class or the youth fellowship. It's very wicked to let other people attend to the Christian instruction of your children. Why should other people look after your children from a Christian point of view? Don't you do anything about it for yourself? Hope looks forward to the next generation. And so he blesses all his sons in two chapters. Love looks outwards to all God's goodness to him. Love looks outwards. And as well as faith, hope, and love, there was a gratitude in his life that looks backwards. And he looked back over all those years and thanks the angel who had redeemed him from all evil. Don't you think that's a great model for your old age? To have in your declining years a faith that looks up, and a hope that looks forwards, and a love that looks outwards to other people, and a gratitude that looks backwards. I think there's something there that Christians should covet for their declining years. You see, according to the New Testament, this was Jacob's finest hour. And I'm very impressed by the fact that in both the Old and the New Testaments, there are special blessings pronounced by God on old age. And I'd like to look at these very briefly tonight. We're not going to have another long sermon like last Lord's Day evening. It was far over long. Did I ever tell you the first sermon I preached was 20 minutes? And the local headmaster came up to me and he said, "Far hour long." And the minister of the church said, "It was far too scriptural." So that's the ultimate damnation in the Church of Scotland today, to be hour long and hour scriptural. Read the book of Acts. One of Paul's sermons lasted for 6 hours. You should be thankful. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I want to look at the rather negative side of old age, first of all. And Ecclesiastes 12 is, of course, a poetic description of old age and what it's like to be old. Now, it is rather pessimistic, so don't think that this is the le dernier mot on old age. This is a passage I never read at funerals because it's so depressing. I have heard ministers reading this passage at funerals, and it's so depressing. It's all about dust and decay and death and going to your long home, all that sort of thing. People don't want to hear that at funerals. You can be serious and solemn at a funeral without being morbid and lugubrious. So I don't read this, because it's a poetic passage, and I'm sure the majority of people at the funerals wouldn't understand what it was about, because it's allegorical. And it describes age in a fanciful and a poetic way. Ecclesiastes 12. Remember, Ecclesiastes is a sad book. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come. Now, this is the pessimistic side of growing old. And the years draw nigh when you will say, I have no pleasure in them. You never heard old people saying that in geriatric wards, saying, oh, I'm scunnered of life, wish the Lord would take me away. I really am fed up, you know, fed up with all these nurses and doctors and people fussing around me in this place. I hate this place. I'm just sick of life. Wish the Lord would take me home. That idea. The years draw nigh when you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, that's your eyes beginning to fail, you know, so that you're not quite sure if the sun's up, you know, or if it's night or what time of day it is. Your eyes begin to fail. You know the feeling, don't you? The moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain. It seems as if life is a succession of calamities. No sooner has the rain poured down on top of you, and you say, oh well, we'll get some sunshine now, and you look up to the sky, and behold, the clouds are there again. Life is an inconvenience. There's no pleasure in it for you. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble, that's your legs, by the way, they begin to shake and get doddery. You know, you've seen old people, terribly frail and doddery and holding on to nurses in the geriatric wards. You should be a minister if you want to see this. Not that you need to be a minister to see that, you just need to visit some old buddies in an old folks' home or a geriatric ward. The keepers of the house tremble. The strong men are bent. That's your spine. You notice how you often say of old people, my, she's getting smarbooked. You know? They tend to draw into themselves and they get a bit bent round the shoulders as if they were carrying burdens. The strong men are bent and the grinders cease. You lose your teeth. The grinders cease. Because they are few. And those that look out through the windows, this is your eyesight again, are dimmed. And the doors on the street are shut. That's your hearing. Notice how your hearing begins to go. Sometimes in old people say, eh? Eh? And you say, my dear, you really must go and get a... Nonsense! I'm not going to wear a hearing aid. I wouldn't humiliate myself by wearing a hearing aid. Well, the doors are shutting, you see. That's what that is. Doors are shutting. Well, hopefully they say, beg your pardon, instead of, eh? But sometimes they do say, eh? The doors on the street are shut. When the sound of the grinding is low, eating, you see, and they don't sleep very well. Old people don't sleep very well. You know, they're up at all the oddest hours. Of course, I know my home country best, but I remember an old fishwife along on the Murray coast, and I would meet her through the day, and I'd say, well, how all right. Well, I just rose at 4 o'clock this morning and left it a fire at 4 in the morning. Couldn't sleep. So she just said, well, I'll just get up and light a fire and make a cup of tea, because old people don't sleep terribly well. Where are we? One rises up at the voice of a bird, anything wakes them. And all the daughters of song are brought low. You lose your singing voice. Notice how it begins to go reedy and tremulous and wobbly and shaky the older you get. And the maddening thing is you can't control it. Even people who've learned about voice control and breath control and how to control your diaphragm and all these things, as soon as they begin to get on, the voice begins to get reedy and warbly. All the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high. Old people don't like high things. You know, I can remember when they used to be afraid of aeroplanes during the war, seeing planes for the first time. They were afraid. And also high-rise flats. Old people gently hate that, you see. Partly because they feel lonely up there. They're shut up in the little cube, you see. X floors up. But also they don't like heights, afraid of heights. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. It's a problem negotiating the street, you see, or stepping off a pavement. You know, they hold your arm when they step off the pavement. And the slightest thing, a straw or a piece of stick blowing across the road, it frightens them. Terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, that's your hair turning white. Lack-a-day, lack-a-day. The almond tree, which is beautiful when it's in blossom, like these flowering cherries that you see at this time of year. So we're getting grey. The almond tree blossom, the grasshopper, this is walking, drags itself along, and desire, which is sexual desire, emotional desire, fails. Whole system has just come to a halt. Why? Because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners are going about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, I think that's a reference to the necklace of coins that a Jewish bride is given on her marriage day. It's part of her dowry, you see, coins. They wear their dowry. And on the day she dies, it was an old tradition that the husband snapped the necklace so that it became useless, you see. And it was a sign that their marriage, as they'd known it, was finished. Just death is a divorce, you see. Death ends all human marriages. Of course, we'll know each other in heaven if we are Christians and if we die in Christ. We'll know our loved ones up there. But there won't be marriage up there as there has been marriage down here. Jesus said so, that there was no marriage and giving of marriage up in heaven. We're all like the angel who don't marry. So there's the silver cord snapped. Or the golden bowl, some people think that's a reference to the skull, is broken. Or the pitcher broken at the fountain, they think that's a reference to the heart, stops pumping. Or the wheel, reference to the heart, circulation, broken at the cistern. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Now, that's the rather negative and pessimistic side, although it's a beautiful description of old age. More positively, in Psalm 71, this is written by an old man. We won't read it all, but you can see that he's having trouble from the people round about him. And he says, he's old and pretty frail, "Thee, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame in my frailty. In thy righteousness," which is often a synonym for salvation, "deliver me and rescue me. Incline thine ear to me and save me. Be thou to me a rock of refuge, somewhere to run, a strong fortress to save me, for thou art my rock and my fortress. Rescue me, O my God, from the hand of the wicked and from the grasp of the unjust and cruel man. For thou, O Lord, art my hope, my trust, O Lord, from my youth." Here's somebody who has trusted God from his boyhood. "My trust from my youth. Upon thee I have leaned from my birth." It's beautiful. Somebody who has trusted God all his life, a personal God, he has leaned on God. "Upon thee I have leaned from my birth, for thou art he who took me from my mother's womb. My praise is continually of thee. I have been a portent to many. People are speaking about him, but thou art my strong refuge. My mouth is filled with thy praise and with thy glory all the day. Do not cast me off in the time of old age. Forsake me not when my strength is spent. For my enemies speak concerning me, and those who watch for my life consult together and say, that old blether, that old fool, God has forsaken him. Pursue and seize him, for there is none to deliver him. Verse 17, O God, from my youth thou hast taught me, and I still proclaim thy wondrous deeds. So, even to old age and grey hairs, O God, do not forsake me. Why not? He wants to do something before he dies. What's that? He wants to tell the next generation about God. Until I proclaim thy might to all the generations to come, don't let me die, God, without having spoken to someone in the generation after me about you and your wonders and your praise and your glory. Even to old age and grey hairs, O God, do not forsake me until I proclaim thy might to all the generations to come. Thy power and thy righteousness, O God, reach the heavens. Who, thou who hast done great things, O God, who is like thee, thou who hast made me see many sore troubles, wilt revive me again. This is before he dies. He wants a resurrection before he dies. Most of us would like a resurrection after we die. This man wants to be raised from the dead before he dies. Thou who hast made me see many troubles, many sore troubles, wilt revive me again. From the depths of the earth thou wilt bring me up again. Thou wilt increase my honor and comfort me again. Would you like to claim those promises for your old age? Psalm 92 and verse 12. Not going to finish this sermon. Really. Psalm 92 and verse 12. The righteous doesn't mean the moral. Righteousness is not the same as morality. You can be moral and go to hell. Hell will be full of moral people. Hell will be full of all sorts of interesting people. Ministers and elders and church members and communicants and popes. Even Dante said that hell was full of popes and archbishops and bishops. Who go to heaven? The righteous. That's different. You see, evangelical righteousness is very different from morality. Evangelical righteousness comes from Christ. It's Christ's own righteousness inside our hearts. Have you got that? You'll never get to heaven if you don't have that in your heart. The righteous, the evangelically righteous, flourish like the palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They are planted in the house of the Lord. They are engrafted into Christ's church, planted into the communion of the saints. They flourish in the courts of our God. They still bring forth fruit in old age. You think you're finished? You're just starting. Jacob's finest hour, just before he died. A personal reminiscence. Granny Jindrova, Maria Jindrova in Czechoslovakia, lovely old lady who cares for visiting preachers and evangelists and pastors and anybody who's on the move in her district of Czechoslovakia. She takes them in and gives them garlic sausage and her own lovely pork sausage smoked with apple wood. Very, very beautiful. Lovely old soul. She lost her husband about 15 years ago. And immediately, lamentation. She was ready to die and she was going to wait to be beside him. And her life was finished and life was not worth living because half of her had gone and so on. God said to her, "Sweetheart, you are just starting." And start she did, and she had a revival. She's still at it today, and she has borne more fruit for Jesus Christ in these last years of her life than she did in all the previous years. She's a great soul. She's not dead yet. She's still bearing forth fruit. The lady who thought she was finished. Well, you see, that's what happens when you claim the promises of God. Verse 14. I like the reference to sap. They still bring forth fruit in old age. They are ever full of sap and green, like young trees. Supple, full of life. And why does this happen to them? To show that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. I wish there were time. Other references, let me read them to you. You can take the reference and read it yourself. It's in Isaiah 46, verses 3 and 4. God says, "Listen to me. You who have been born, B-O-R-N-E, you who have been born by me from birth and carried from the womb, even to old age I am he, and to grey hairs will I carry you. I will carry you and I will save you." Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 29. "The glory of young men is their strength." True. That's what we admire in young people. But the second line, "The beauty of old men is their grey hair." Grey, presumably, not just through age, but through hardship and tribulation in which they have learned the grace of God. Now I want to say to the young folk, you know how much I love you. And it's because I love you that I can say all these things. And it's because I love you very much, all you young kids here tonight, that I'm going to say the next bit. Don't think I despise you. You see, all of this teaching on the importance of old age contrasts very strangely with the accent and the emphasis that's put on young people today in the churches. And I'm sure that, well, Pastor Seaton calls it youthism. It's a jolly good word. Although I think perhaps he's a bit hard on the young people. Never mind. Youthism is not a healthy thing in the churches. One hears of services being conducted by young people. What kind of young people? Are they Christian? Why should services be conducted by young people just because they're young people? Who said that young people have more to say about Jesus Christ than old people? It wouldn't be so bad if you could be sure that the youngsters were converted. What guarantee is there that the young people who are allowed to conduct the public worship of God in some churches today, what guarantee is there that they're all converted? Do they all know Christ? Are they experts at the Word of God? I think not. Young people, I love you. Just wait for it. You'll notice from the General Assembly that the question of young people being admitted to communion is being discussed. It's coming down to presbyteries. I'm quite sure the presbyteries won't accept it, but never mind, perhaps they will. Some presbyteries would accept anything. Young people coming to the Lord's Supper, meaning Sunday school children. Which young people? The Christian ones? Are they all Christian? Are all the children in the Sunday school, Mr. Fraser, Christians? Or are they all Christians because they've been baptized? Which is virtually what one of the ministers said in the General Assembly. They must come to the Lord's Supper because they've all been at the holy font for holy baptism. So children are Christians now because they've been baptized. Holy humbug. Children are not Christians because they've been baptized. Children are Christians if they're converted, and they're converted on the same terms as grown-ups. Are there two ways of getting saved? One way for children and another for grown-ups? Now, of course, I do think that young people can be saved. That's why we have Sunday schools. It's to bring them to Jesus Christ. That's why we have youth fellowships under Wim Simpson. It's to bring them to know Jesus Christ for themselves. But you don't just admit all young people to the Lord's Supper. The only people who should come here, whether they're young or whether they're old, are people who know Jesus Christ and love Jesus Christ and served Jesus Christ. There is almost an idolization or a deification of young people in the churches. Has it ever struck you, friends? How little emphasis there is on young people in the Bible. Take the Christmas story. We've sentimentalized it, haven't we? We say, ah, Christmas is for the young. Who said so? How many young people do you read of in the Christmas story in the Bible? We've sentimentalized it with angels looking like fairies floating around in Christmas trees covered with tinsel. Parties, children's services, children's choirs, lessons read by young people. Oh, Christmas is for the children. Who said so? There are no children in the Christmas story in the Bible except Jesus. The child, he's there. The shepherds would have been older men. Mary and Joseph weren't young. Joseph was an old man. In fact, they think he died shortly afterwards, because you don't read of him after Jesus is 12 years of age. There's an old tradition that Joseph was an old man, if you know the old cherry tree carol. Joseph was an old man, and an old man was he when he married Mary, the Rose of Galilee. Mature people. Elizabeth and Zacharias. Mercy, they were so old that when John the Baptist arrived, their son, people were amazed. Anna and Simeon? Mercy, they were so decrepit, waiting in the temple for the consolation of Israel. When the baby came in, they could hardly hold the child. They were so frail and aged. You see, the gospel story is for mature people. Now, I'm not saying that young people can't become Christians, and thank God for all the young people who do become Christian, and thank God for the children who become Christians in the Sunday schools. But the emphasis on the Bible is on the beauty of old age and the worth of old age and the respect due to old age and to maturity. This was Jacob's finest hour. In closing, turn to Hebrews 11. Quickly, we're past quarter two, you see. I try not to go beyond quarter two. Hebrews 11, the heroes of faith. Hebrews 11, well, by faith Abraham, in verse 17, offered up Isaac. In verse 20, by faith Isaac invoked blessings on Jacob and Esau. Verse 21 is the verse. By faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph. You know, 130 years are ignored. Extraordinary. Not Bethel and the ladder, not Peniel and wrestling with the angel, not his 20 years wanderings up in the north, not the two wives and all the other sons, not what a difficult character he was and what a scoundrel he was and what a usurper and a cheat he was. None of that. 130 years just ignored. The New Testament says this was his finest hour. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. 130 years summed up in one verse. What about the young people? Well, the young people are now under an obligation to prepare themselves for that kind of old age. Amen. May God bless his word. Now, I didn't finish the sermon. The end of it was really about election and why Ephraim and not Manasseh. So we'll have to think about that some other time maybe. And this was the hymn about God passing by some. 687, we sing verses 2, 3, and 4, and verse 6, four verses only. 2, 3, and 4, which are, pass me not, Father, pass me not, Savior, pass me not, Spirit, and then verse 6, love of God so pure and changeless, and we'll use the tune Grösven, number 448.